Nashville Convention will come to order. It's on April 2nd. The items on the agenda are
to complete our bill tonight. And we have to move fast. So, first item on the agenda is the adoption of the minutes as printed.
Madam Chair, I'll move the minutes.
Thank you. The minutes have been, the motion has been made to accept the minutes as printed. Senator Doms, is there any discussion, corrections? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you. The first item on the agenda is House File 2683 and Senate File. There is none. 2683. And this was eliminating a sunset. Mr. Burkett?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just provide a brief overview of the bill. House File 2683 makes three substantive changes for the Minnesota State's individual retirement program. Section 2 of the bill removes the expiration of an early retirement incentive program, which is currently set to expire on July 1 of 2019. Under current law, the Minnesota State is permitted to incentivize certain eligible employees to retire by offering cash inducements not to exceed 1 year's salary. Minnesota State can also offer contributions to the employee's health care savings plan. And eligible employees are those who are older than age 55 and have at least 5 years of employment with Minnesota State. The decision whether or not to offer that incentive is made by Minnesota State. The other two substantive parts of the bill are removed by the 3A amendment, and so I'll cover those in a moment. The rest of the bill really makes technical and conforming changes. The largest section of the bill deals with recodification of former Section 354B.21. The purpose is to better organize the section. This section covers the right to elect into TRA, and there's been various situations that the commission has heard a number of special bills that deal with the individuals who are unaware of their election rights. The point of this section is to make that more clear for people who are administering the bill, or rather administering the program, and making use of the statute. The 3A amendment, I'll just note last week this bill came in before the commission and was removed from the agenda, as you may recall, and that's because there was some disagreement between the parties in Minnesota State regarding.
Yeah, it's on.
It is on. I don't know if I can get someone to turn it up a little bit. The 3A amendment, members, would remove three sections from the bill that apply to the supplemental retirement plan. And it's, as far as I understand, it's been agreed to by the various groups affected.
Mr. Burkett?
Madam Chair, that concludes my comments.
Oh, thank you. Are there any questions? Mr. Hughes?
Madam Chair.
Good evening.
Yes. Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Limmer and I are just sitting here trying to figure out, this is very well organized, but we're just a little confused. We're on number two. We're on House File 2683. The amendment, then the omnibus retirement bill is number three. And that's 2632. So this is a separate bill. We're voting on that separate. There's maybe some amendments to adjust rate? Okay.
That's correct.
All right. Thank you.
It is correct, right.
That is correct.
See.
That's the right one.
But this is 382.
But it's gone to a different bill.
Madam Chair.
Yes, there's two 3As, and one is, they're two different bills.
Madam Chair, would staff have any? I don't seem to have this.
The yellow. We're on the yellow.
Yes, I have no yellow, except this is Senator Limmer's. Are there any others around here?
Yes.
Oh, excuse me. Mr. Hughes.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. My name is Derek Hughes. I'm the System Director for Total Rewards at Minnesota State. And joining me, I have my colleague, who I'll introduce himself.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, my name is Christopher Dale. I'm the Senior System Director for Labor Relations with Minnesota State Colleges and Universities.
And do you have any remarks to make about the bill as it's before us tonight? Is it acceptable to you as it's before us tonight?
Madam Chair, yes, this bill is acceptable, and thank you to Mr. Burkett for the introduction. As he stated, the portions of this include a removal of a sunset for our early separation incentive and also a rewrite of the eligibility section of our IRAP section for readability and understanding. And we did work with our union partners as well to verify that we weren't making any substantive changes to that, just technical changes for clarity.
Okay. And there's an amendment in our packets. What do you think about the amendment to the packets, Mr. Dale, Mr. Hughes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment, excuse me, is to remove the changes to Section 354C, and we were not able to come to consensus this year. We also believe that it requires some additional study and both of the fiscal impact to the system and also the impact to employees. And we do agree to remove it.
And you're advocating that we put this amendment into the bill?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And we should remove sections 13 and 14 and page 11 and section 15 on page 12.
Yes. Madam Chair, that is correct.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, I'll move the H2683-3A amendment.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question. So on page 11, it says delete sections 13 and 14, but on page 12, there's a continuation of section 14, and it doesn't specify that in the amendment, but I'm assuming that's correct, that on page 12, section 14 is deleted as well. Is that correct?
Ms. Burkett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Jasinski, that's correct. Deleting Section 14 is the entire Section 14.
Thank you.
So we're deleting Section 13, Section 14, and Section 15.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. I had that same question when I was crossing out, and I left 14 in. So I got confused. Not the first time. Or the last. Okay. Any conversation, more conversation about the amendment as the Nelson amendment? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify about this amendment? So it's agreeable to everyone. All in favor of the Nelson amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Is there any further discussion about House File 2023-3? 2683. Senator Rosa.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move that House File 2683 as amended be recommended or laid over for possible inclusion. Be recommended to pass and incorporated into the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. The motion is before us. Any further discussion? All in favor of the Rosen motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. We're making great progress. Now we're going on to the Omnibus Retirement Bill as amended. 2632, Senate File, House File 2632, Senate File 2583. And the next item of business for that, Ms. Lincheski.
Okay, I'm just going to give a little. So this is the bill that will be our omnibus pension bill. So Amendment 1A is amending the bill that Representative Murphy just mentioned. And we are going to do a quick run through the omnibus pension bill as it is in 1A, starting with Chad, and then I will do a couple sections and we'll go back and forth here. Louder. Yes. Loudly. Thank you.
Mr. Burkett.
Thank you. So I'll go through the first couple articles and then turn it back over to Ms. Lincheski. Article 1 is the MSRS administrative bill, primarily makes technical and administrative changes for MSRS. Article 2 contains two bills related to PARA. The first is the PARA phase retirement option from House File 2633, Senate File 2584. That makes the program permanent, phase retirement program permanent. It was otherwise scheduled to expire this year. The second bill is House File 2598, Senate File 2490, which modifies the amount of the annual contributions paid by Minneapolis to the PARA Police and Fire Fund on behalf of the Minnesota Police, the MPRA and the MFRA. I think I'll turn it over to Ms. Lincheski.
Ms. Lincheski.
Madam Chair, Article 3, is dealing with the PARA statewide volunteer firefighter plan. This is a section or a bill that was prepared to assist one particular township, but it was determined that there was a need generally to add a provision to the statewide volunteer firefighter plan chapter to allow municipalities to leave the plan. So there's a process set out in the bill, which would require full vesting of firefighters, the allocation of any assets or surplus assets in excess of benefit liabilities, and then would allow for the making of immediate distributions to the firefighters. There is a session law that grandfathers what is happening in the Brevard Township so that they can proceed with this termination and distribute benefits. Article 4 of the bill is the State Auditor's Fire Relief Association Working Group bill. That makes a number of changes, many of which are non-substantive. The substantive changes, though, I'll note, are defined benefit plan vesting requirements are reduced so that instead of a graded 20-year schedule, it's now a 10-year schedule, which is now identical to the defined contribution plan vesting schedule. It also adds a requirement regarding what is the applicable benefit level when a firefighter does not return from a leave or if a firefighter dies. That was an open question, and the bill now answers that. And then another substantive item is that it does allow for supplemental benefits to be distributed to designated beneficiaries in estates when there is no surviving spouse. Another section of the bill of Article 4 deals with the City of Austin. This is a kind of recurring item. The only change really here is that the exemption that would allow the city to allocate the fire state aid between the Relief Association and its contributions to para, police, and fire would have expired on July 1 of 2019, but it is now being extended in the bill to July 1, 2020. The hope is that we will have general legislation that allows for this allocation, and there will not be a need going on into the future to continue to extend the expiration date. Chad will carry on with Article 5.
Mr. Burkett.
Article 5 contains two bills for Minnesota State. The first, House File 2489, increases employee contributions to the TRA employee contribution rate. So that's from 4.5% to 7.5%. And the second bill is House File 2671, Senate File 243, which increases the employer contribution to match the employee contribution rate in the previous bill. Article 6 is made up of generally applicable retirement changes and includes sections from three bills. The first is House File 2373, the State Auditor's Working Group Bill. Sorry, I didn't say the Senate file name, 2491. That particular provision increases the threshold for triggering an enhanced reporting requirement from $25 million to $50 million. The second is from the MSRS admin bill, and that creates a section exempting MSRS, para, TRA, and SBI from a general requirement in 16E requiring the use of minute services. That exemption currently exists in 16E. The third is from is its own bill, House File 2631, Senate File 2621. And that creates the one-year exemption for City of St. Paul and St. Paul School District, allowing them to continue to make contributions to the supplemental plans for trade union employees. The bill also directs the interested parties to work with LCPR staff to draft legislation to permanently address the issue there.
Ms. Rancheski.
So finishing off the amendment, Article 7 deals with MRF. If you recall the presentation on that, it increases the state's contribution to PARA on behalf of the Minneapolis Employee Retirement Fund from the current $6 million that is in the statutes to $16 million. And then Article 8 is the state aid to local governments for contributions to PARA. This is the aid that is due to expire on June 30th of 2020. The amendment will extend the expiration date to the earlier of June 30th of 2048, which is the end of the amortization period for PARA, or if it should happen earlier when PARA General achieves full funding. And that's all.
All right. There's an amendment. For the City of Austin.
Technicals is 2A.
Oh, technicals first. 2A. Amendment 2A comes first. I'm sorry. Ms. Lencheski. Mr. Burkett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The 2A amendment is the LCPR staff technical amendment. I'll just quickly cover what the amendment does. It removes requirement that the LCPR file a report to each legislative body, at least biennially. I understand that that's not something the LCPR does. To correct some internal cross-references throughout the statutes that we have jurisdiction over, for places of work conformity with compliance, to clarify fire state aid reporting standards, reinsert language that was deleted in error in the 2019 Omnibus Retirement Bill. That relates to segmented annuities and the calculation of benefits for former state employees who terminated before July 1 of 1997. It also clarifies a change to the 2018 Omnibus Bill that relates to coverage for foreign citizens by the Public Employees Retirement Association. And it makes a conforming change for interest paid on certain refunds by the Public Employees Retirement Association. It exempts certain fire relief associations from reporting requirements that are non-applicable. and finally replaces the several varying terms that refer to interest rate assumption with a term that we're going to use consistently now, investment return assumption.
Any questions? Anyone want to testify about this amendment? Do you like this amendment? Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I move the 2A amendment.
Representative Pappas moves adoption of the 2A amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. So now, Amendment 3A is before us. This has...
Should I do it?
Please, Ms. Lencheski.
Okay. This, again, relates to City of Austin. So this amendment actually extends the expiration date on into whatever future date that is when we have general legislation that permits the allocation of fire state aid. It also relieves the city from liability for having to make contributions to the Volunteer Firefighter Relief Act, Relief Association, that should have been paid to the Relief Association under current law. So this continues with the exemption that we have been providing for the City of Austin, and it makes it sort of indefinite until there is general legislation, so they don't have to come back next session and get it, another extension.
And the people that are here for Austin thinks this is a wonderful idea, right? Heads are nodding. Any further discussion, Senator Rosen?
Madam Chair, when you are ready, I'd like to move the 3A amendment.
We're ready.
Thank you. I'd like to move the 3A amendment, please.
Okay. Senator Rosen moves the adoption of 3A. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. The amendment is in. Okay. The next amendment is 4A.
A little overview.
4A is Ms. Lencheski.
Okay. So this is the bill that we took up a couple weeks ago, I believe. This relates to the purchase of allowable service credit under the PARA plans for military service. The amendment amends the language that had been in the bill when it was originally considered here in the Pension Commission to address some of the concerns that were raised at that time. I will just I'll just mention the changes that were made to the bill that appear now in Amendment 4A. The first change is that this is the leave that can be purchased that is not the federally protected leave. So this is leave, military leave that occurs prior to public employment. So the protected leave, the USARA leave, so-called, occurs during public employment. It's when someone leaves and comes back, and then they are the plans are required to give them the option to purchase that military service. This the changes to the section that we're talking about here deal with the other type of leave, which is leave that occurs prior to public employment. In order to address some concerns about the length of time and some of PARA's concerns, there is now new language that's been inserted in 6.16 and 6.17, those lines, 6.16 and 6.17, that now, in addition to having a cap of 5 years, it also now is only permitted for the initial period of enlistment, induction, or call to active duty without any voluntary extension, which is, it mirrors the language in TRA. And when we considered this the first time, we heard from TRA's executive director that this is the language that they have, and now it has been dropped into this this amendment also. Another change that's made to address some concerns appears over on line 7.4 to 7.6. This allows PARA to charge $250 to any member who would like to purchase this leave for the cost of doing the calculation. And it's not so much, I understand from PARA, the actual need to recoup these costs, but really to make sure that someone who comes in and asks for the calculation is serious about making this purchase. The next change relates, it's more of a technical change. It relates to how the calculation is done of actuarial equivalency or actuarial cost. These are in line 7.9 to 7.12, and they relate to how the calculation is done. It excludes a certain the alternative way, which looks to what would have been the employee and employer contributions, and in the absence of any pay for that period on which to determine that, it's kind of irrelevant to this calculation. So the third change that really addresses, and it's the fourth change here in the amendment that addresses concerns, is it appears that line 7.14 to 7.16, and it allows the allowable service credit to be used for all purposes except for purposes of computing a disability pension. So this was one of the concerns PARA raised, in that it makes it very expensive for PARA because that isn't really baked into the actuarial cost. So this excludes that allowable service for purposes of computing a disability benefit. Those are the changes then that are made to the bill that you considered a couple weeks ago.
Senator Pappas.
I think Mr. Anderson is going to testify, but I just wanted to see if all the stakeholders are satisfied with this bill now.
They gave me the thumbs up just before the meeting, and I see a thumbs up. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On line 7.4 to 7.6, we're talking of this administrative fee for $250. Perhaps counsel can tell me how often do members apply for this type of calculation? Do we have a number?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Lincheski.
Senator Limmer. It would be a good question, I think, for Doug Anderson. He'll be able to answer that question. I don't recall exactly how many, but I know that there are many requests, and they run the calculations, but there's only one out of 30. I guess I'm guessing now, so we should ask
and
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair,
Senator Limmer.
This is in order to calculate what their payment would be to buy back time. And do we offer to include the $250 in that total cost? Or is this in addition to the total cost of the buyback?
My understanding, Ms. Lincheski.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, this is in addition to the cost of doing the buyback. So it's really a gatekeeping, has that kind of a function. So you come in, if you want the calculation done, you write a check out for $250.
Madam Chair, I don't know if anyone else is thinking this way, but I can understand why you want to have a gatekeeping function there. But for those who go forward with the total purchase, my idea is to include the $250, that would be included in the buyback, and that it would not be an added expense. If there is an added expense, or if there's just the separate $250, you're going to get rid of those people anyway if they're not going to buy back. And then we keep their $250, or the pension fund keeps, or they had, I don't know who keeps it, but whoever keeps it, they're going to keep it, and the word will get out that you have to be pretty serious to invest $250 to figure out the calculation. But if you go forward, I think that should be included in the buyback. I don't know how to put that in the form of an amendment, but I think it would be something that you're not keeping anyone out then. You're attracting the very people that want to invest in the time going back. And I think that $250 should be included in the buyback figure. Is there a way to write an amendment to that effect?
Ms. Lincheski.
Yes. Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I think we could just add on something at the end of line 7.6 in place of the period, comma, or maybe with the period in a new sentence, if the member proceeds to make the purchase, the amount of the purchase payment amount shall be reduced by the $250 already paid.
All right.
Something like that?
Yeah.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members will recall that this is an area that we had a robust discussion on. And the Chair had asked me to work with the stakeholders, and I did. And these are the things that we came up with. And Senator Limmer, that's exactly what this is sort of a gatekeep on the $250. And if I understand what you're looking at, you'd pay the $250 regardless of who you were, but you're envisioning it as a credit for somebody who actually moves forward. Is that what I'm
right.
hearing?
That's correct.
And maybe that's the way it should be phrased, as a credit, that the fee would be credited toward if the member moves forward. That might help simplify the language for what Representative Senator Limmer was looking at. And that was the purpose. PERA will speak for themselves, but as I recall the conversation, they had concerns about the amount of staff time that's required to generate these reports, and so a bump in the road, if you will, is a gatekeeping mechanism. That's where the $250 came from. Your point is well made, Senator Limmer, that if someone would have come in without asking for that, they wouldn't have had that. There could be a credit back, and I think that's a reasonable amendment to the bill, or to a reasonable amendment to the amendment, excuse me.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I would really like to hear from Mr. Anderson, because the whole point is to try to reduce the administrative work. And while he's coming up, frankly, the paybacks are probably $40,000 or $50,000 or something. So it just seems to me that I understand the principle of it, but it does seem to me like $250 shouldn't really matter.
And Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess the question I had, I think you, in the introduction of this, that it was said that TRA already has this type of provision. Do they have the $250 gatekeeper? And I guess the other question I would have for TRA is, how many people actually inquire every year, and how many people actually get paid back? And maybe TRA could come up and give that information for background.
Right. Thank you. I think we had testimony on that the other night, but we can be reminded. Mr. Anderson, do you want to make remarks?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commission members. Back on March 19th at the hearing, we did go on record as not opposing this bill. Did cite a few issues that we thought were important for you to know. Included in that were the administrative costs lacking from the bill at that time. So the Amendment 4A does include that, and it does help us out. We get about 50, before this provision sunset in 2013, we would get about 50 to 60 requests per year, and either one or maybe two members would take the request. So, and the amount of time that it would take to provide an estimate was about 5 or 6 hours per request. It starts to get fairly significant, not enough that we have to add personnel, but what it does is it changes the flow of our work. Puts a priority on doing these calculations, delays work for other people. So we felt that it was important to be compensated for that work, the administrative work. So I think it serves two purposes. It is a gatekeeper. It makes sure that members who are interested would understand that there is some work involved and there's a potential cost. But part of the view was that since there's effort put into it, that some compensation for that effort would be appropriate too. And that was just one of the concerns that we had raised. We talked a little bit about, at that time, back on March 19th, low member election rates. And I guess because the election rates are fairly low, we're not overly concerned with whether the cost for someone who elects this, it comes through to PERA, or whether it's part of their kind of refunded back to them as part of the final cost of the purchase. The third thing that we had noted at that time was just the difficulty we have in capturing the true actuarial equivalent cost, because we can't really account for all the different possibilities that can happen with members, whether it's early retirement, disability, changes in COLAs, changes in provisions, and so forth. So some of those have been addressed by the ability to capture the costs for early retirements, and also by adding some protection about disability usage. So. Again, overall, we're not opposed to the bill, and if I haven't answered a question that was asked before, I'd be happy to take them now.
Okay. Mr. Stoffel?
Madam Chair and members, Jay Stoffel, Executive Director of the Teachers Retirement Association. And in response to Representative Nelson's questions, we have the authority in our law, and well, I'll back up a little bit. We've had this authority in our law since 2009, so it's been in our law continuously since then. We do not assess a fee, although we have the authorization to do so, and we're revisiting that at this point. We may begin to do that. And I think I'm trying to remember the other question. The number of people. In the last 5 years, we've had 35 requests for these calculations, and there has been only one individual that has actually made the payment. So one person in the last 30, one person out of 35 in the last 5 years. And just as a way of background, on average, the average payment amount for those 35 different calculations is about $108,000, for representing on average 3 years of service. So think of that group of 35. On average, they're trying to buy 3 years of service at a cost of $100,000. So ways of paying for that is either write us a check or transfer an IRA or deferred comp money that funds of that sort could be used to purchase the service credit.
Thank you for that information. Representative O'Driscoll, how did you arrive at $250?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We felt that we wanted to have something in there. We batted around a couple of different ideas. We didn't want to make it onerous, but we also wanted to make it significant, so that when someone looked at us like, oh, I have a fee that I have to pay, and we will know that whether we have serious inquiries or not based on that fee. So it's really not intended to be punitive, but to be something that gives a person pause to say, yeah, I really do want to move forward with this, or maybe not at this time.
Okay. And did you consider up to?
Madam Chair, we did not specifically talk about a range. We just chose the 250 as what we thought would be an adequate solution. Some wanted more, some wanted zero at one point, as you well know. And so we figured that 250 would be a reasonable dollar amount to help offset, as Mr. Anderson said, the 5 hours or plus that they may at the PERA through a workshop will have to deal with that. So,
Ms. Lincheski, does this authorize as a PERA, or this says that PERA must charge it?
Madam Chair, it does say that the member must submit with the application payment of the administrative fee in the amount of $250. So there's no flexibility or discretion there. Okay.
Mr. Anderson, do you have a remark
about... Madam Chair, I would just say that the fee seems fairly reasonable to me. I think one thing that we would want to do for the member is just to give them a little bit of a, maybe we can provide them some examples when they first have an inquiry so they could consider whether they want to take the step forward of going forward with the actual application fee.
Sure. Okay. Any further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Limmer.
Madam Chair, are we still on the... concept of the amendment that I was talking about? You know, all I hear is the hardship on this type of pension fund, and we're not talking necessarily about the hardship that the veteran contributed 3 to 5 years of military service overseas, sometimes in very dangerous conditions, and we're actually quibbling about $250 that we're charging to the veteran. I'm kind of surprised that we're even charging $250 to a person who took 3 to 5 years out of their life to work in the military overseas. But I'm not even going to argue that point. If he goes forward with it, I think the least we could do is credit that $250 to that individual cost. And I would like to move the amendment.
Madam Chair?
What is the amendment?
I'll have counsel read the amendment again, Madam Chair.
This language is what we're talking about. Right. Right.
Yeah.
Oh.
all the veterans, Senator, all the veterans,
yes,
all veterans don't haven't been overseas.
Oh, well, that's true. Information.
But all veterans take time off from their jobs.
Sometimes.
Would counsel repeat the amendment, please?
Yes, and just to be clear.
Mr. Lincheski.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just to be clear, Stephanie James is Senate counsel. You all know her. I am still learning some of the parliamentary procedures and amendment procedures. Because this is an amendment to an amendment, we need to, the proper form is to approve the entire amendment with the new language that we are going to add here. And the language that we are talking about would come at the end of 7.6, that sentence, after the period. And what I've written down here is, if the member proceeds with the purchase, comma, the administrative fee will be credited toward the purchase payment amount, period.
That's fine. That works.
Senator France.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks, members. I would move the 4A amendment incorporating the language as quoted by Ms. Lincheski.
Thank you, Senator France. How compact. Would you, Ms. Lincheski, will you repeat the amendment? The compact amendment.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. At the end of the sentence on line 7.6, we will be adding in, if the member proceeds with the purchase, comma, the administrative fee will be credited toward the purchase payment amount, period.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. The amendment is to the amendment. And the amendment. Right? Moving on.
This is 4A. Yeah. 5A.
To 5A. Ms. Lincheski.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a little tough to decipher what's going on with Amendment 5A, so you need to read it along with, starting on page 21 of the 1A amendment. So starting at page 21, the change made is to remove the... So this deals with vesting. So this is vesting in the case of a defined contribution relief association. There is a provision at line 21.28 that states that a member can have as many as 20 years, a relief association can require as many as 20 years of service to become 100% vested in his account. The change in the amendment would remove the 20 and replace it with 10. So the most that could be required by a relief association is 10 years of active service before becoming 100% vested. Next change in this amendment is to line 30 on the same page, and that relates to page 21, line 30. Instead of the word larger, so it would say provide for a, it says right now provide for a larger vesting percentage. This is, in no event may the articles of incorporation or bylaws of a relief association provide for a larger vesting percentage than is provided in the following schedule. The change is to replace larger with lower. So what this does in effect is it says that you can't, that a relief association cannot require, not provide for less than 40% vesting at 5 years of service, which is kind of a flip of the current situation, wherein with 5 years of service, a relief association cannot provide more than 40% vesting. So, for instance, under current law, a firefighter with 7 years of experience would be 64% vested. A relief association could not give him more vesting than 64%. Under the amendment, the same firefighter with 7 years of experience would be 64% vested, but a relief association would not be able to require more, provide less than 64% vesting. So it's a flip of what the law currently provides. The same changes are made over on page 24 to the defined benefit relief associations who that also have the same vesting requirements. So if you look at page 24, line 5, you will see that there is a limitation on the relief association cannot require more than 20 years of service. That would be changed to 10 years, just in the other case with defined contribution plans. And then the vesting schedule would be similarly changed so that the relief association could not provide for a lower vesting percentage than is provided in the chart. And that is the amendment.
All right. It's whose amendment is it?
Okay.
Is there anyone that wishes to testify about this amendment? Come forth. Auditor Blaha.
Thank you, Chair Murphy.
Hennessy.
And members of the commission. I think we have several members of our State Auditor's Fire Relief, Volunteer Fire Relief Working Group with us today. We ask you to hold off on 5A and 6A, and maybe I'll save us a little time because I have pretty much the same testimony for both on here. We have had the working group is where we have all the stakeholders, and this is just the kind of thing we like to dig into. We have not had the chance to have a discussion on this, and we are concerned about unintended consequences. We're concerned about some issues with autonomy, and we'd like to take a look at this in more detail. In fact, this group has asked the working group in the past to take a look at an idea, and then bring back to you either our suggestion or at least the context of our debate. So as we look at this, I think one thing we have to be mindful of is that in both amendments, it does seem that the intent is to make relief associations more consistent with private retirement plans or large retirement systems. Now, these associations are just not the same as these types of plans. They're essentially length of service awards paid to firefighters who volunteer their time to provide service in the community, and almost all relief associations are one-time lump sum payments. So I think I have to be really careful about being overly connected to the idea that they have to be the same as those other systems. We also know that these amendments will require some other changes, for instance, in the accrued liability factors that we have not addressed, would require some thoughtful analysis. We want to vet these for unintended consequences so we're not rushing anything in and finding out later there's something that we missed or an opportunity that might even be better. So to be clear, we haven't vetted these. It's not that we haven't agreed or any of that. We have not had the discussion in the depth that we typically have on an issue like this. And I can tell you from the fact that many of us are physically here and we have talked to our group, we would be certainly happy to take this up and provide to you some more detail to which to make your decision. And then also, if it pleases the chair, I know Director Hennessy Hennessy Allen also has some of the specific answers to some of the questions I think we've heard.
Ms. Hennessy-Allen.
Madam Chair, my name is Rose Hennessy-Allen. I am the Pension Director at the Office of the State Auditor. And Senator Pappas, we did review the most recent data that we have for relief associations. And for the defined contribution plans, they are allowed to have 10-year full vesting right now. Only about 21% of them have chosen to do that. All the defined contribution plans that have a higher vesting requirement are either at 15 years or 20 years, but that's for full vesting. All of them provide for reduced pensions, for reduced vesting for firefighters with less than 20 years of service. In the defined benefit plans, all but 8 have reduced vesting. About 78% offer reduced vesting starting at 10 years of service, and then about 18% have reduced vesting starting at 5 years of service.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Senator Sinjum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To any of the witnesses, I would just like to know, based on what you just said, what provides a greater incentive than this amendment right now to retaining volunteer fire department members in our communities across Minnesota? In my mind, it's a serious problem. These are genuine heroes that give and give and give and give and give. And if this amendment is useful in terms of providing an incentive for them to continue to give, then I think that's important to us. So can just kind of boil it all. Is this good for the retention of volunteer fire department members? That's my question. Do we need it? It's important. It seems to be where I live.
Mr. Johnson, Mr. Rosenblum.
Madam Chair, Mark Rosenblum with the Golden Valley Fire Department and the President of the State Fire Department Association. Senator Sinjum, to answer your question, I can tell you that as thinking in terms of a recruitment tool, most people who get on a fire department and want to volunteer have no clue what a pension is about and really aren't interested in the pension at that point in time. As they grow in their career, that's when they start thinking about the pension and start thinking about what's in it for them. But most people get into the fire service with an intent to serve and to give back to their community. And that's pretty clear. I can't quote directly out of the study that was done by the Humphrey Institute about 5 years ago, but that was clearly one of the findings, is that that's not a tool that is, it's something that we talk about and we let the people know when they're starting on a fire department that is out there, but their intent for the most part is to serve and to give back to their community, not to get a pension.
Okay. Senator Sinjum.
Thank you for that. What is the harm of making it 10 years versus 20 years, or keeping it at 20 years?
Mr. Rosenblum.
Madam Chair, Senator Sinjum, I don't know that there's a harm. I think all we're asking for is a chance to work that through the committee, just like we do with everything else and have done with everything else over the last several years as part of the auditor's working group. It's a tried and true process that involves the right people and involves the right members of the fire community to be able to answer those questions, take them back, and even if we have the opportunity to survey fire departments, then we have better information.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I would just say that, again, as I have said, that these are two heroes. I don't know where we'd be in the state of Minnesota without them. I know where we'd be. The state of Minnesota would run the state fire department. That's where we'd be. And that would be massively expensive, as you can imagine. So I don't know. We'll see what we do with the amendment, but I tend to kind of lean Senator Pappas' way.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a little bit of background on this, some thoughts that occur to me. A number of years ago, 5 or 6, something like that, maybe a little longer, we revised the PERA, police and fire, moving the retirement age from 50 to 55. And what that did is something similar to, I think, that could happen in this situation by reducing the vesting schedule or vesting time of service for full benefit from 20 down to 10. It cost a number of people to go out on retirement under the old plan. And we're still in the state of Minnesota trying to backfill that gap and loss within law enforcement. As a matter of fact, our state patrol right now continues to remind us as a legislature that they're having difficulty keeping retaining qualified candidates within the ranks of our own state police department. My fear is that if we don't allow this group the opportunity to survey its members, to get out and to look at this, we could see that vesting age or number of years of service move from 20 to 10. A bunch of people who are thinking, gosh, I'd like to get out, immediately become vested because they've got 10-plus years of service, and we lose those people, and we only compound the problem. I think something like this bears some real consideration and moving forward, and maybe just laying this amendment on the table, letting the work group do its job and come back with a more robust recommendation so that we don't move a lever and have an unintended consequence. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
I wanted to ask Mr. Johnson about the reserves because it's not a money issue, correct? I mean, you have the money if people are vested younger.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, yes, it's not a money issue. I think the issue is, to Representative Driscoll and Mark's perspective, ultimately it has to do with choice at the level of the fire department. I mean, the Fire Department Association represents the 20,000 volunteer paid on call. I apologize, I forgot to mention my name was Ron Johnson. 22 years in Maple Grove for me, and I'm on the working committee, on the working group rather, and have been for several years. And I have to tell you that being able to go back to Bemidji or go back to small town Minnesota or large department, and to be able to make them feel like they're being represented here, I think ultimately that's really the key. And it is not a money issue, but it really is about trying to put that control at that particular level and not requiring a tenure, but making that something that the local relief can do.
Mr. Rosenblum, President Rosenblum.
Madam Chair, thank you. To Representative O'Driscoll's point, I give you a personal example. I started with a class of 18 people that came on several different fire departments at the same time. 10 of those people in surrounding departments near me had 10-year vesting, and they have all been out of the fire service for more than 10 years now. They came, they did their 10 years, and left. And I can think of 2 out of the 18, including myself, that have served the full 20-year term. That is a very real example that he gave.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think this seems to be a lot larger issue than just these two little sheets of paper. And I think having the volunteer fire department working group look at this and come back with recommendations is probably a better idea than doing this quickly tonight and not knowing all the information. So, Madam Chair, I'd like to lay the 6, the 5A, and 6A on the table.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I think that's a non-debatable motion.
Okay. And then we don't discuss it at all. Right. Thank you. All in favor of the Nelson motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay. The motion is adopted. Thank you. And then you'll do that this summer? Ms. Allen?
Madam Chair, that's correct. The working group will reconvene in the fall.
Okay. And you'll take 5A and 6A up this summer then?
Absolutely.
All right.
Chair.
Representative Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now that we're not on any amendment, so it can be discussed. I didn't realize until this moment that Representative Nelson also laid over 6A. And I did think it was important for us to have a discussion about that issue. So maybe at some later time we should really talk about augmentation, because under Senator Rosen's bill that we did last year, we really eliminated augmentation. And I asked for this amendment to be considered just for consistency purposes, and they could argue that they shouldn't be consistent or whatever. But I hope the working group will also look at the augmentation issue.
We will ask them to do that. Okay.
We're having to 7-8.
The next item on the agenda is Amendment 8A. Ms. Burkett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The 8A amendment is a TRA purchase of service credit bill that's been put as an amendment to the 1A amendment. What the amendment does is it allows an eligible person to purchase service credit for a period of approximately 1 year and 4 months back in 2008. It defines an eligible person so narrowly so that it can only apply to one person. I believe that person is Dr. Abbas Mehdi. And then if Dr. Mehdi elects to purchase, then Dr. Mehdi is responsible for the entire cost of the service credit. I'll just have one comment, and that's that due to several factors, one of them being this rather late amendment, the staff has not had the time to vet the facts for this amendment as we would for a normal special bill.
Okay. A bill that's been introduced in both the House and the Senate?
Yes, Madam Chair, it has. The bill is House File 2630, Swadzinski. Nope, prior. And Senate File 368, Swadzinski.
So Senate File 368?
That's correct.
All right. Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I asked the staff to put this amendment forward on behalf of Senator Swadzinski, who I think his constituent has a story he'd like to present to the commission, and then we need to hear from TRA.
Okay. Senator?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As a contributor to TRA for 33 years and a recipient for 3, I wish all teachers sat through one of these meetings to see all the work and time and energy and effort you put into to what we end up receiving. This amendment before you today will help my constituent, Abbas Mehdi. Mr. Mehdi is a professor at St. Cloud University who in August 2006 started a tour in Iraq serving as a senior advisor for the Bush administration and a team leader to help rebuild our efforts in Iraq. He requested an extended leave of absence from MINSCU and served in Iraq until he was forced to come back because his life was in danger to the United States early in January of 2008. Professor Mehdi was later asked by the federal government to resume his tour and did so from January 2010 through May 2012. What was supposed to have been a single extended leave of absence became split. The first part of his tour had to be classified as a general leave of absence, and as such, he was not allowed to buy back that time towards the credit and towards his pension. Iraq was a war zone, and these kinds of unpredictable situations happen. We need to give this citizen, this hero, in my opinion, a break. He went to a war zone, and when it got exceptionally dangerous, he was evacuated. When asked to continue serving later on, he did not hesitate to answer the call of duty. We were asked last year to wait until this year, but we cannot wait any longer. Mr. Mehdi is an American hero and plans to retire at the end of this year after what should be classified as 30 years of service. Here to testify further is Professor Mehdi.
Mr. Mehdi.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, member. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to be here. Briefly, I'm originally from Iraq. I left Iraq in 77, went to UK. I had my master in UK, and I came to United States, finished my PhD from Ohio State University, and I came to Minnesota, and I've been a professor at St. Cloud State University for 31 years. I'm the victim and the enemy of former president of Saddam Hussein, and I've been engaged in active opposition for Saddam Hussein. But until Saddam invaded Kuwait, and with the help of former Senator David Denenberger, introduced me to the White House, I become engaged active with the U.S. government. And since 1990 until 2003, when U.S. went to Iraq, I engaged on the high level with the U.S. government, planning to the future of Iraq. And to show you how old I've been involved, these two articles published in Star Tribune, one in 1990 and one in 1991, about my activity against Saddam Hussein. When the United States went to Iraq, Iraq was very dangerous. And the State Department asked me to go there because my background and my language. And I did go there. And I served on the best possible way. And then the Iraqi government chose and awarded me to give me a cabinet position in the Iraqi government. Unfortunately, I couldn't continue for health reason. I had to come. And after 1 year, again, the U.S. government nominated me and sent me to the World Bank in Washington to be in charge of Iraqi file. During my service with the World Bank, I was Vice President Joe Biden was directly supervising the Iraqi file. So I did my duty both for Iraq and for the United States, and now I'm asking you to help me to give me a credit for my service. My university recognized my service for 31 years, but the TRA, they want to count only for 29 years. So that's why I'm here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Mr. Stoffel. Mr. Stoffel.
Madam Chair, Barth. Members, Jay Stoffel, Executive Director of the Teachers Retirement Association. And I'm here with...
Rachel Barth, Madam Chair and members. I'm the Legal and Policy Director for the Teachers Retirement Association.
Please Madam proceed. Chair, and members, I'd just like to start by saying we fully appreciate the service that Mr. Medhi has given to the country, to the state of Minnesota, to all of us. We greatly appreciate the service. So in no way do our comments reflect anything other than that. We're here just to basically testify that we do have military leave provisions in our statute. So when an educational institution such as St. Cloud State University classifies a leave for a faculty member as military leave, then they have the right to purchase that time. The college reported the leave as a general leave, and that does not qualify for purchase. We've been in contact with them since. All of that has occurred, and they stand by that categorization. So with that, we just don't have the authority to accept any payment for the leave time. It's an unfortunate situation, but that's the current status of the laws of our authority.
Ms. Barth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to build off of that a little bit, in order to be granted a leave, the employer and the employee have to come to an agreement on the type of leave and the duration of the leave. So when that's established, that agreement is then sent over to TRA, and TRA provides the member with information about that leave, specifically whether the leave is eligible for service credit purchase. And based on all of our records, Dr. Medhi and St. Cloud State, his employer, came to an agreement that it would be a general or an alternative leave, as it's classified in the statute, which explicitly states that that type of leave is not eligible for service credit. So this amendment would allow an exemption from the law without what we see as a clear policy reason. The Pension Commission typically looks to see if there is an employer or a plan error, and based on our records, neither type of error occurred in this situation. So we are concerned about the precedent of this type of exemption, again, without a policy, clear policy reason behind it.
Senator Pappas.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I spoke to Mr. Stoffel on the phone today about this, and could you just share with us a little bit about the amount of money it would take to do the pay for the service credit, and then your advice in terms of payback that you shared with me on the phone,
Mr. Stoffel.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, the cost if the bill were to pass, this amendment was added to the bill, would be $40,160, and that represents we have two ways of calculating what the person would owe. It's either an actuarial value or the contributions plus interest, whichever of those two is higher. And this represents the contributions plus the interest, so that's $40,160. And his benefit would increase as a result of the purchase by roughly $190 a month. He's got some options as to take joint annuitant coverage and so forth. So there's several different options that he would be presented with. But roughly $190 a month would be the increase in the benefit. So that payback period would be roughly 15, almost 16 years. So the benefit goes up by that extra amount compared to the cost it takes to get there would be about a 16-year payback period.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
I assume that, I'm guessing that or someone told me that you're around 70, my age, in other words.
Yeah.
And so 15 or 16 years is the payback period, so you'd be like 86 before this whole plan, you even break even. So the question is, why do you think this is worth it to you? I mean, we have a problem because it sets a precedent that we don't want to set, but I also don't think it's necessary.
May I, Madam Chair?
Professor Mitty.
I met with the TRA several times, and I have it in handwriting. They told me it cost me $12,000. And I met with them several times, and they told me, no problem. We did it before, and we do it again. And for my first leave was extended leave, actually. But because I didn't complete the 5 years, the university changed it. I didn't know about that, actually. But the TRA told me it cost me around $12,000, and it takes me between 2.5 to 3 years to pay it. And I have it in handwriting for them. And all of these years, before I go to Iraq, because I had a colleague with me at the university told me, be careful, your service would be account. So the president of my university, the human resource, and the TRI, all of them, they told me, it will be count. Don't worry. You are a hero. You're doing a great service. And when I came until last year, I went to the TRA, and I have it with me here, the paper in handwriting. They told me it will count. We did it before. It does not cost you more than around $12,000. But now they change the whole things. I don't know what's going on.
Mr. Stoffel.
Madam Chair, well, it's a little difficult to respond without knowing what the $12,000 is based on. That sounds to me like it could be a calculation for a leave payment for the time. I just don't know. It doesn't sound like an actuarial calculation, but a cost of a leave, a military leave payment, if it were classified that way.
Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Professor Mitty, how are you compensated in both salary and benefits while you were touring overseas in this capacity?
I took leave without pay, so I was paid by the U.S. government.
Yes, but how? Like, by check each month? Or?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Correct myself. There is a contractor with the U.S. government, and they were paying us, USAID, which is U.S. government.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. One follow-up question. So how did that salary compare to your teaching salary at the time? Above or below or where in comparison to that salary, just as a question?
It was more than, because there is a dangerous pay, something like that. So it was more about 50 or 60%. But, yeah.
And then just
to follow up. Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this follow up, so I understand the salary was more, but was there any pension related benefits included as part of the military as well or none? No. Just the salary?
No. Salary, and I have here with me, I'm a contractor with the Defense Department when I was there, because I want to keep my job. Actually, I was offered several times a job with the U.S. government, but I wanted to keep my job as a professor, and I wanted to serve the United States, and that's what I did.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. A question that I have is, members are Ms. Lunchesky, Mr. Burkett, how does this fit with our principles?
Madam Chair, I would just repeat what Ms. Barth said, which is that in the absence of error, under the principles, and I think based on the precedent of the Pension Commission, we typically don't do this type of special legislation unless there is an error on the part of the employer or the plan. I would also just add that there is an appeal procedure at TRA. So if some of these facts are not known at this point, like what the $12,000 means, it is possible to flesh out the record here by going through the appeals procedure at TRA, which could be done at any time.
And is there anyone from the university here? Mr. Dale, Mr. Grant, thank you. Do you have anything to say in response to the questions that have been asked or to the charges that have been made?
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, I was not directly involved in...
Your name, please.
Christopher Dale, I'm a Senior Assistant Director for Labor Relations, Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. While I'm not directly employed at St. Cloud State or am responsible for the decisions to grant or not grant leaves that they make, it's my understanding that in this particular case that the initial leave was initially intended to be a statutory extended leave, and because it was cut short, that leave was later converted to a general leave, and that subsequent leave was an extended leave, and that we can only grant one extended leave under the statute that for which the participant can purchase service credit. And so that's the problem here, is that there were two leaves rather than one, and only one of them allows for the purchase of service credit. Other than that, I can't speak to the particulars of Mr. Professor Mehdi's situation except to say that he's a well-regarded professor at St. Cloud State University.
Okay. Any further discussion? Senator Pappas.
Yeah, Madam. My concern is that, out of respect for Mr. Mehdi as a military veteran, we could approve this, but I think there's still going to be the dispute over how much you'd have to pay Mr. Mehdi. You know, we are only aware of what TRA tells us. So I suppose then you could do the appeal process that Ms. Lunchesky mentioned. But it seems to me that if it was $40,000 in 15 years, does that sound like that would be worth it for you to pursue this?
No. Yeah. I worked on it, and I've been working with TRA based upon they taught me that, mm-hmm. and I have it there, the table. I have it here with me. They said around 12,000. Mm-hmm. But obviously, I don't know why somebody in the office there, he doesn't want me to have these years, my service. Mm. And when I came here, they found this issue of 70. This is the first time I heard about the issue of 70. I would never try it if I knew it is 70. There's no, because they have average survival for person is about 12 years. Why I pay the money? Mm-hmm. I did ask them. I'm a professor and I know exactly what I asked them how much it cost me. And they gave me the answer and they gave me the calculation and I have it here with me.
Professor Mehdi, we can't resolve this at this time. And Ms. Lunchesky acknowledged, or Ms. Lunchesky checking the principles of this commission, and said that there, in her response to my question about the principles, she said to Mr. Stoffel about brought to our attention that there is an appeal process with the TRA, and I suggest that you go back to that appeal process and that we lay this over and find out what happens, because we certainly need more information than the conflicting information that has been given to us here. And our principles say that there has to be, and the law, the statute says there has to be an error. And so I know that you feel that there's an error, but we can't be the judges at this time without more information about your charges that you made about TRA. And so there is interim, and we have used it twice tonight, and we've used it twice in previous meetings this summer. And so we are going to have interim meetings, not more than one meeting. And so I suggest that you accept that we wish to lay this over.
Madam Chair, every Iraqi person work with U.S. in Iraq. U.S. brought them here. They spent millions on money to bring them, reward for their working with the U.S. forces. And I'm the one who sacrificed. I put my life in danger. And this is my years. I served at the university 31 years. My university recognized my 32. Why, when I retire, I get paid for 29 years? I don't think this is fair. And whatever TRA they want to do, this is not fair. I served 31 years, and I want to get my retirement for them. That's why I came to you, because they don't want to do it. In spite of they promised me so many times, not once, not 10 times, not 20 times. And now they change the story.
And in the remarks that you made, you also said that the chancellor or the president said one thing too, and that differed. And I don't know. We are not judges in that sense, and we cannot say what the amount can be. Everyone that comes before us and asks for a buyback has to pay the full actuarial charges. And we don't determine those charges. The plans determine those charges. And so, therefore, I'm asking for you to let us find out what those all are. And they're also, the attorney said that we have to have consensus with the university system and the plan.
I just wanted to know, I'm going to leave with a sense of predicament, and I feel I've been treated unfair by the TRIA. And I seek your help, because I believe my cause is legitimate, and I put my life in danger, and the United States rewarded everybody who works with them and helped U.S. forces in Iraq. I'm now retiring and being paid less than the years I service, my service.
Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. I have nothing further to add to his eloquent statement, but thank you for your time this evening.
This bill is laid over, or this amendment is laid over. Amendment 9A.
Madam Chair, the 9A amendment is another individual bill that's been converted into an amendment to the amendment. This one comes from House File 2775.
Madam Chair.
Senator Jasinski.
Mr. Burke, I don't know if your microphone is bad, but both of us are having a tough time here. I thought it was just Senator Pappas because she ages me a little bit, but it's both of us, so if you could speak a little bit closer to the mic. Both of us are trying to have a tough time hearing you.
Mr. Burkett.
Madam Chair, I'll try to speak up.
That was better.
Okay.
Please proceed.
So this this amendment, similar to the last one, the difference is that it's a transfer of service credit, so the person that this refers to had service in the IRAP plan previously, and this bill would identify that person. I believe it's Ms. Sarah Gidnolski, and once, if she chooses to elect the transfer under this amendment, she would pay to TRA the difference between the IRAP contributions and the TRA contributions going back to 1995. Then the balance of her IRAP account would transfer to TRA, and then Minnesota State would be required to pay any remaining amount required to keep TRA whole. And then I'll just make the same comment. I'll just make the same comment as the last, that staff hasn't had the opportunity to vet the facts and possible legal implications as thoroughly as we'd like.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, on behalf of Senator Latz, I asked for this amendment to be considered. We could see if he has any additional comments. And I believe TRA is in supportive of this amendment.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for considering this amendment. Representative Joaquim and I are here on behalf of our constituent, Sarah Dahl Gidnolski, who is unfortunately out of town this week. We have prepared the information for this committee. This is a situation where the facts are not in dispute. Ms. Gidnolski indicates that she did not receive the form that entitled her to make an election for the defined benefit plan at the time that she first became eligible for it. Minnesota State was her employer. They have indicated to me that they do not have any record that she was given the opportunity. They can't find a form in their file. TRA similarly has no record. And they have both indicated to me that they do not object to this request. And they are here and present and willing to state so on the record if the chair desires to hear that or to fill in any other details that you request. Ms. Gidnolski understands that she will have to buy in, and she's prepared to do so. It's important for her to have the opportunity this year because a year's delay would cost her a substantial amount of money. We did kind of a back of the napkin analysis in our head shortly before the hearing, and she would have to pay in about $240,000 is the approximate number that the TRA came. That was not the back of the napkin analysis, but a delay as a guesstimate would probably cost her about 7% of that, or around $14,000, if this were not resolved today and instead were delayed until next year. It would cost her that much more to buy into the plan if the committee decided next year to accept this. So this isn't a dispute in facts. This appears to be clearly an error on the part of the employer in failing to give Ms. Gidnolski the documents that she is required under law to have so that she could make a choice through no fault of her own. So we respectfully submit she's entitled to have the opportunity to make that choice if she is willing to do so and is willing to make the payment into the system to achieve those benefits. So we ask for your support, and we're happy to answer questions. I don't know if Representative Yoakim has anything to add.
Representative Yoakim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just would ask for you to consider this appeal. Like Senator Latz said, this was Ms. Gidnolski was never given the information, and both Metro State and does not have any of the paperwork on file that they even offered it to her, and she would have taken that option if it had been offered. So I'm sorry that she can't be here today. The hearing came up kind of quick, so she wasn't able to attend.
And this amendment is exactly like House File 2632 and Senate File 2583.
Madam Chair, it's House File 2775.
Thank you. 2775. 2775. Long time since January. I would like to hear from TRA and the state university system. I have talked with both Representative Joachim and Senator Latz about the situation, and I told them both the same thing about interim study. But they both decided to pursue, evidently, which is their right. So you heard the information, and you're all for it, huh?
Madam Chair, Derek Hughes, System Director for Total Rewards for Minnesota State. As Senator Lotz did indicate, we do agree that we do not have proof or a form indicating that Ms. Janulski was offered her right to elect TRA. We do have a form that indicates she had a right to elect IRAP. So in the absence of that information, we do agree with that statement that she was not offered her rights under the law.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to understand how this works then. So all her current defined contribution plans, her IRA, whatever, would get rolled over to TRA, and will that be enough for full actuary value? And if not, do you make up the difference then, Minnesota State?
Yes. And Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, and I know Representative O'Driscoll always asks me on testimony as well. Each year when we testify about these, the value of her IRAP will roll over to cover a portion of the actuarial cost, and that will leave a difference of $78,523.62 for Minneapolis campus to pay on behalf of the participant.
Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think this question is for Mr. Stoffel. So we say we offered it, but we don't have proof. What is the mechanical process? I guess I'm unfamiliar with it. So if they elect defined contribution or defined benefit, when they check one, is that saying they're opting out of the other one? And then second part of that question, what does this open ourselves up to as a state if we had a form back then that didn't verify that we offered them both?
Mr. Stoffel.
Madam Chair, Senator Jasinski, Jay Stoffel, Executive Director from TRA. The mechanics might be better answered by the college. We don't maintain those forms. We don't keep those forms, or we don't process those forms. The election time happens when faculty members first hired, and they have, they need to make that election within the first year of their employment, and then they have another opportunity at tenure time. So that all happens at the campus. And those forms are maintained by the Minnesota State system. So we get the reports as to what is elected, but we're not involved in that, the mechanics of the process.
Senator Jasinski.
Again, Madam Chair, to follow. So again, if we can't prove they're by picking one, they're not picking the other one. How does that defend ourselves from this coming up multiple times in the future if we don't have that form that says I picked this, but I chose not to choose this one? Again, I'm concerned of the precedence of what this is setting, that, you know, five or six more people come back and say, well, I didn't get the form and I didn't sign it. And, I mean, this opens ourselves up as a state to a lot of these claims, and that's my concern with this. So can you follow up on how that is taken care of and what is our liability in this instance?
Mr. Hughes.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Jasinski, you're absolutely correct. This could come up again and again and again. And the statute as it's written under the IRAP with the 354B eligibility says we have a one-year window to make the change. As Mr. Stoffel noted, faculty get a second chance election, but this person was not a faculty member, so they didn't have that second chance. And outside of that 1 year, the statute precludes Minnesota State or TRA from making changes because it's outside of that 1 year to change that person's election. So currently, the only vehicle we are aware of is coming to this commission with an individual legislation bill.
But I can remember there's been times where we've asked the institutions to pay for the mistake. And have you considered that? You're not testifying and saying it's a mistake, but if she didn't, if there's no papers that show that she made the choice, there seems to me a mistake was made or an error was made. Do you want to respond to that statement?
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, Christopher Dale, Senior System Director for Labor Relations with Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. I think the prior testimony has acknowledged that we are not able to prove that the election was offered based on the paperwork that we have now from 1995. But if you do not use the contributions that were made and accumulated in the IRAP plan, that would mean that the participant would, and they were allowed to keep that, as well as requiring the college to pay the entire cost of the actuarial value of the service credit, that would leave the college, that would leave the participant as getting a windfall, contributing both pensions, both pension plans, not one or the other. And so that's why the process is to use the accumulation in the IRAP plan to defray the costs of the actuarial value and then force the college, if there are additional costs, to pay the remaining amount.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I thought I heard something different there. Is the college going to pay this $78,000, or is the employee going to be paying the $78,000 to get the actuarial cost?
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, I believe the process is that the college will pick up the remaining portion of the actuarial value that is not covered by the current assets in the IRAP plan. So that's the $78,000 the college will be paying.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How many times do we go through something like this every year? It seems like the error of not reporting or not being offered a form or confusion, it is a costly mistake. I'm wondering if there's something we can do over the interim to get an analysis or some kind of how effective the process is and if it is right for reform.
Comes up every biennium anyway, if it's not every year. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to chime in on a little bit of what my colleagues have been talking about. It does seem like we see these just about every year, or pretty darn close, maybe a couple one year and nothing the next. But we do continue to see this. And apparently, as I recall from previous testimony from Minnesota State, they admit that they have had a record-keeping issue on it. And I don't think that this is the last of these we're going to hear. It may be at somewhere downstream of how we're going to be hearing about this. But I do think that we need to find a way to shore this up so that we can find an end game to this at some point. Mr. Hughes is right. I do ask the first question. I also have the second question that I usually ask, and that is, Mr. Hughes, do you know if the individual has been made aware of, or Senator Latz or Representative Joachim, because investment values on the IRAP plan change as markets change, the numbers are not necessarily hard numbers, and they may change over time. The percentages, the ratios may be the same. Is the individual in question aware of the fact that that number may change if they delay paying that in a month or 2 months or 3 months or 4 months or 6 months or a year or 2 years down the road, that is not a hard and fast number, that it may be subject to change? Mr. Hughes.
Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll. I do not know if she's been made aware that the number could change. I have been informed that she's aware that she's going to have to buy in, and the cost to her of buying in were it to happen around now, which is the $240,000 or so. Her husband had, I have been informed her husband might be coming tonight. I wouldn't recognize him. So if he's here in the room, it would be helpful to let us know. Okay, perhaps he couldn't make it. All right.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that is how we have handled these in the past, is the numbers that we have are estimates based on the day, perhaps today or a point in time, where those can be subject to change given market conditions. I'm not asking for or hoping for a market correction tomorrow, but it could occur, which could really throw and skew these numbers. And I just want everybody to go in eyes open with an expectation that delaying this could either increase or decrease the amount of money that both the university and or the individual in question may have to pay. And I just want to be on the record with that, as I have every time when I come up, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Senator Latz, did you talk to her since Saturday night when you talked with me on the phone?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay, so we don't know if she's retiring in 2019 or if she's planning retirement, when she's planning retirement.
I don't have any information about when she plans to retire, Madam Chair.
Okay. But this is also a case of adding, the more time we add, she has to pay more.
Madam Chair, I have some more information to answer your question, if I may. The staff behind us has indicated she's 53 years old and they don't think she's planning to retire anytime in the near future.
So it wouldn't hurt.
What wouldn't hurt?
It wouldn't hurt her retirement if we held this over.
Well, Madam Chair, if you held this over and it took her another year, it would probably cost her $14,000 or so, increased cost to buy into the plan, is what I am told. For a mistake that she did not make, as Representative Joaquim has reminded me. And it seems to me as if there really isn't a dispute over the facts here, so I'm not quite sure what value there would be in holding interim hearings or delaying any resolution of this.
Thank
you, Madam Chair. I think this is very similar to what we've done in the past, as we've mentioned. And I don't know what the error rate would be, but if you figured that how many hundreds, thousands of employees there are, and we get maybe one or two of these every year or so, that's a pretty low error rate when you think of all the record keeping that's involved. I hope we'll go ahead with this. I don't think it's going to so much hurt the Senator Latz's and Senator Joaquim's constituent, because it sounds like whatever's in her IRA will roll over, but it'll hurt her the college, because they have to make up the difference. So if already they're at $78,000, another year they would be at $92,000. So it does seem to me important that we go ahead with this bill. And I would just to try to move things along, I would just move the 9A amendment.
Mr. Stoffel.
Madam Chair, I have nothing else to add.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess the question I have here, if there's a delay, who picks up that cost? Is it a cost to the employee, or is it in cost to the employer, which would be us, the state, or is it split between the two? And I guess if it's a cost to us as the state, then I would say it behooves us to do this now if these facts are not in dispute, because we're going to be saving money to the state. And even if it's the cost of the employee, I think that because the facts aren't in dispute, it does make sense to get it done and taken care of and move forward.
Okay. Mr. Hughes.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, the answer to your question is it would cost the state, the university, more money. The employee, as the bill is written, would have to pay the missed contribution amount, so the 4.5 of the IRAP versus the 7.5 of the TERI's 3% difference, plus compounding interest in 1 year is not going to be a significant amount of this person's salary. But with the actuarial value increasing with her salary for one more year, as Senator Pappas indicated, would be a growth, so it would cost more.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and that's the point I've been trying to make, that if 53 has been represented in this case, someone may work till 65. I don't know that it's the desire of this commission to keep open this option for 12 years for retirement at a fixed dollar amount when the university, as Representative Nelson talks about, would be responsible for picking up the difference. And that's why I asked the question, is there going to be a change for the employee, and are they aware of that? And if there isn't going to be a change in the dollar amount, I think it behooves this commission to put a sunset on it so that we can at least contain the cost for the university.
Mr. Hughes, Mr. Dale, I'm sorry. How many times have you, in your employment history, and you've been through this before, how many times have you come back and said to the legislature, we want this statute that guides us in this kind of choice kind of thing, in this particular statute that we're working under, we want this changed and reviewed? If ever?
Mr.
Ullman, anybody back there?
No, never. We have not. I've only been with the, I apologize, Madam Chair.
Oh, you're brand new.
I've been here 6 years, so
okay.
But in my tenure.
We've done more than one in 6 years.
Yeah.
Mr. Dale, do you have anything to add? Have you got suggestions for us of how we can change the statute so that we don't have to keep going through this pain?
Madam Chair, I don't have any suggestion that has been vetted with the various constituent groups that would probably want to have a voice in any such change.
But you'll work on it?
We could certainly commit to trying to work on it.
And you'll come back to us before my term of office is up?
With certainty, Madam Chair.
I really ask you to do that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Bring forth, and then next year, then we will definitely have some suggested changes to make in the statute so this doesn't happen so much. Mr. Stoffel.
Madam Chair, just for maybe to help explain how these kind of things can happen. This was back in 1995, and I was with the Duluth Teachers Fund back in 1995, and I was part of the effort there with the Duluth Technical College. And we were careful at the Duluth Retirement Fund office to keep the records. I think the records were also kept by the college, so there were dual sets of records. I don't know if that happened with the other TRA-covered institutions, but along the way, I did hear a story. I can't confirm it today, but I think it might be worth checking into as to another reason why these kind of things can happen. There is a place where these records were stored for all the other institutions, and that place was flooded, and those records were lost. And it was before all the electronic kind of record keeping that we do now, where we can scan, and it's all backed up in two or three different places. That may help explain. You're all in this situation wondering, how can this happen? Well, back in 1995, and around that time frame, when places were flooded, records were lost. And it's unfortunate. That may help to explain why that at times these records cannot be found to verify a form was put in front of a person and they picked a choice or so forth.
I realize that too, but there's still that person up at Lake Superior that thinks that we made a big mistake.
But we have his form.
And she wants to come before this, and I keep not doing it. So maybe... we'll. Senator Pappas renews her motion. Oh, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate Senator Latz came to my office today, I believe, to talk about this and left a message on my phone, and I really appreciate this. It is difficult, Senator Pappas, to have this conversation without your constituent here to ask some of these questions, I will admit. That's a little frustrating. And I just, too, want to remind the members that this is a cost that's going to be passed on to the employer, and passed on to the state, and passed on to our state budget. So I understand that this is a special circumstance, but it is there is some frustration with it, Senator Latz.
And I agree with you, Senator Rosen, but I'd rather have it vetted here than on the floor of the Senate or the House. So, and we know how persistent Senator Latz is. So thank you, Senator Latz, for doing it here than Representative O'Driscoll.
So, Madam Chair, to my question, is this open-ended and costs are fixed to the employee and they're just borne by the university? I'd like to know before I vote on this as to how much I'm obligating the state of Minnesota to continue to pay.
Council, Ms. Lincheski.
Madam Chair, the right to the right to make the transfer and make the payment out of the IRAP and over to TRA expires after 1 year from the effective date of the bill, of our omnibus bill. So that's included in the language here, and it is lines 2.28 and 2.29.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any further discussion? All in favor of the Pappas amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. 1 minute left.
Madam Chair?
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, I have the 10A amendment. And if I could, Madam Chair, I'd like to go through it.
Yes, you may.
Thank you. It deals with, on the amendment, line 3, deals with the Minnesota State Colleges and University retirement provision, and we're actually eliminating Section 4 on page 32 of the bill, which is the increase in the employer contribution rate for Minnesota State's IRAP plan from 6% to 7.75% by FY24. So this is to match the employee rate increase, and this is this is basically an unfunded mandate, as I look at it. Line 4 on the amendment is to delete Article 7, which is on page 36, and that has to do with the MRF provision. And that is assumed by MRF. Was merging into the para, and they would Minneapolis would be their contribution would go from $31 million to $21 million annually, and the state's contribution would increase from $6 million to $16 million. So that would be a fiscal impact of $20 million in FY 2021, and that is we, as I've said before, when we had this discussion there, we've been working on MRF for a very long time. I think this needs to be reviewed more. This has not been budgeted in the targets for this amount of increase. And I'd like to delete that section. Also, to delete on page or line 5, delete Article 8, which is a state aid to local governments for employer contributions for para. And that is also another cost to the general fund of $13.2 million in FY 2021. And these are both, these last two issues, the MRF and the para, we've really have not studied it. We didn't realize these were coming. We passed a very aggressive, responsible bill last year, and something that we worked on for 3 years. There was no mention at all of these two provisions, and that they would have to be dealt with this year. And again, the $13 million for para has not been budgeted for. I'm not sure where that would come from. So, Madam Chair, I'd like to offer the 10A amendment.
Senator Krentz.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Rosen, for your amendment. As you know, we debated this in a previous pension commission and it passed. And I simply point out to the commission that this allows the employer and employee contribution rate to stay the same. Since I'm not in charge of the finances in the House or Senate, I understand the question about the budgeting, but I just wanted to state for the record, I still think it's good policy. I'll be voting no on the amendment. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my hope this session would have been that there might have been some dedicated money in the governor's budget related to pensions, the work that Senator Rosen and I and others, Senator Pappas and others, for the last 3+ years to get a bill in place. My concerns are as follows on this, in order. Number one, MRF is not broken at this point. We're looking at a different allocation on that. The system is in place. The city of Minneapolis and their ancillary involved organizations and that would like a different split. If we are going to do something, my suggestion, if we find money, if there is money that becomes available at some point in the process, that we would look more favorably upon the PERA portion, because that is money that is in state statute that's already part of the bedrock of the work that was done previously, and that is going to affect and benefit all communities across the state of Minnesota, where MRF is targeted at this point, again, where we don't have any money in the again, we have just heard from the Senate Finance Chair that she doesn't have money in that. We know that the governor's budget doesn't. We know that the House is working in different levels to try to find that funding. My order of preference would be that if we do find money, that we do the PERA. Number two, if we do find additional money, that we work on the IRAP and that contribution, because we do have some statutory things there. And at this point, number three, the MRF is not broken. It is a preference of how we would like to move forward. And it is my hope that the commission would look favorably upon Senator Rosen's amendment. We would vote to take those out, and we would have discussion on prioritization, and we could perhaps do a supplemental if money became available, and the commission could move that forward when we have money in an agreed-upon order should funds become available on that. I've had some heartburn on this. I've watched the process go through as we were looking at it, but I am going to be supporting the Rosen Amendment this evening, because I think it's the prudent thing to do when we don't have dollars that are dedicated on this. And if there are three sources that we're looking at, I think we need to have a preference on how that would be our recommendation coming from the commission, which, again, number one would be PERA, because it benefits all communities across the state and it preserves the work that we did to preserve Minnesota's credit rating and the viability of pension plans in the state of Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further discussion? Anybody from the audience that wishes to testify? Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and I'm also testifying on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities and the Association of Minnesota Counties. I respect the concerns that Senator Rosen has identified of the issues relating to the cost of this amendment. However, as I think most of the members of the commission know, the PERA aid has already passed the property and local taxes subcommittee, has an additional expenditure that will be made out of that committee's budget, and we assume for right now will ultimately come out of the tax, the omnibus tax bill to be passed by the full tax committee and ultimately the House. I would just indicate that we think this action is premature. As we understand it, the Senate Tax Committee will not be coming out with its bill until after the Easter break. And consequently, the priorities have not been determined for that committee, and the possibility exists that money can, in fact, be found for this. If it's not, we understand that that is going to be the result. But just to remind the committee what this is an aid that was given to all PERA employers with the exception of school districts who had the offsetting reduction in their TRA expenditure for the rate increase that occurred in 1997 of 0.7%. Since that time, our contributions have increased 2.32% or over 45%. The sunset on it was premised on the fact that the deficiency of the PERA general plan would be amortized by the 2020 date. As you all know, that, of course, has not happened. The plan is only 78% funded at this time. So, again, from the perspective of the three organizations, we ask you not to make this decision right now, but that you delay it until the tax committee has determined its priorities in the Senate.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to ask you, what is your wish for this bill ongoing, and when would you like it to? It has to go to the appropriate state government committees and then on to finance and ways and means? Can't remember.
My wish for this bill is that we have one that can pass on the floor of the House of Representatives and one that we can pass on the floor of the Senate. My wish on this bill is that we will both have ways to fund it, and two portions of the bill have funding in the House forever, or at least has the opportunity in another committee in the House of Representatives, if not funding. Mm-hmm. But I'm still hopeful that there will be a target given to us for pensions. That being said, I tried to figure out what the target was for pensions, or the target was for anything, from the paper that was issued last week on how the Senate was set their targets, and I frankly couldn't figure out even one target, one of the targets that were on there. But I think I looked at the Capital Investment Committee, and I figured out that Senator Sinjum has $100 million plus maybe two or three to spend.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if we want to go down that route right now.
I'm not either.
Okay. Thank you.
So,
Madam Chair,
I was just
so
trying to be complete, give you a complete answer.
Well, I appreciate that, because I feel the same way as Representative Driscoll. If there's anything in this amendment that would need a second look, would be the para provision, Article 8. But conversations haven't even occurred with the Senate tax chair yet. So this was brought to my desk maybe 10 days ago, maybe 2 weeks. There was no time to even set a target for this. So I am very open to looking at this, but I am asking your wishes on your time frame. When do you want to have this to the floor and the process?
Well, the House, we're supposed to have the bill to the all our bills should be completed, or at least into ways and means, by the 12th. And this bill has to go to several committees. So I was hoping that tonight would be it.
Madam Chair.
But that was before the phone conversation that we had this afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I would just like to express just a little bit of frustration, too. We've had one introductory pension meeting, and we've had three pension meetings to go over a bill that has eight articles in it. It's been extremely difficult for many of us to be able to attend pensions because our committees run up to exactly to when we start. There's LBO. We've had LBO. We've had many other issues that have been in a conflict. So it seems a little disjointed, this bill, and I wish we were more succinct on voting this out. I was wondering how you would feel about working on this bill on a continual basis. And the reason I ask what your time frame was as chair is, this does have several committees to go through before it gets to the floor, but we haven't had time to really take a good look at some of these issues.
I'm willing to have another meeting. The House appointees to this commission were waiting over a month to have appointments made to this commission. And so that's why we seem to be backed up in time, because we didn't have a whole commission. And so that's part of it. And so we can have another meeting. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just again, visiting the history of the Pension Commission and a little bit about how business has been done in the past, and that doesn't necessarily mean that business gets done the same way in the future, but the Pension Commission has always kind of been one of the last wheels up things before we are done. And given the feedback that you are hearing tonight, I know in the past when it's been Democrats in control in the House and Republicans in control of the House, we've always been able to successfully secure a waiver from the Rules Committee to be able to continue to move this. Maybe that rule or that idea has changed in the House. I don't know that information, but I don't know that this, again, traditionally has always had to follow the deadlines, and maybe we'll get a clearer vision as to where monies might be and a target might be, and perhaps that would help the Commission get a better comfort level on the House and the Senate side, knowing where things are moving, if we would have that opportunity to learn more about that particular item and how that might work as things become clearer as time goes on.
Those are wise words, Representative O'Driscoll, and I have gone to the Rules Committee in the past, and I'm willing to go to the Rules Committee again. And I would, like I said to Senator Rosen, I'm happy to have another meeting if we're going to try to fund it, to talk about funding and the targets. And I know that Majority Leader Gazelka and Speaker Hortman have weekly meetings, and so they could talk about it again, or if they ever talked about it.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just for informational purposes, the governor's budget did include the MRF money in his budget, and it was included in the target that was given to the State Government Finance Committee. So that money's in the target, and I believe I heard that the other piece is being carried in the tax bill. So yeah. And the House side, the money is moving through, is in the budget's targets.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, we were not aware of this until it was posted Thursday night. I called yesterday to let you know that there was problems with this. Finally contacted you today. We do have the 10A amendment before us that perhaps we should make a motion or take a vote on that and then proceed from there. Okay. Whether to.
The other thing is, if we do look at meeting again next week, what we can do is we can take the Rosen Amendment tonight. We know that we've got something that I think will pass, and we can move that process along, and then the Commission can continue to meet as we get a clearer idea on targets, and then we might be able to do an amendment to the pensions bill as it's moving through the House and the Senate. Senator Pappas and I have done that in the past, stayed very close contact when there were some items that needed changing and needed to work on to make sure that we were doing the amendments along the way. And I would suspect that school of thought is something that could be employed. But we could get the bill out tonight without those provisions and continue to work on those as we got a clearer vision and understanding of what was happening. That is a possibility.
Or we could adjourn now and I call another meeting.
Well, Madam Chair, we have the 10A amendment before us.
Any further discussion? Rosen amendment is before us. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Aye. Not hearing four voices on both sides, the amendment fails. Any further discussion? This
division.
Meeting is adjourned, and we will call another meeting at a later time to be announced.